going to go ahead and let's get us started because our time is limited, and then getting in here and getting settled has taken us several minutes too. So we'll kind of move fairly quickly through some material today, and then I'll hang around afterwards if there are more questions or discussion, things you'd like to talk about. And also, I forgot to do this yesterday, but let me give you my personal email address in case you have further questions that we don't have time for today, or just want to contact me for any reason. It's just my name, Tracy Herod, at Gmail. Well, and you know the .com part, I'm assuming. So please feel free to contact me for any reason. I'm always happy to hear about what folks are doing. I wish we had time, actually, that we could sit and listen together to each person and what your involvement is and what your interest is in this subject and what brought you here today. I would love to have time to do that. So if we don't get to do that today, please feel free to share with me later in person or through email. So if you don't know me yet, my name is Tracy Herod. I'm from Boise, Idaho, and I work in several programs there that are involved with folks who are coming to the U.S. through refugee resettlement. Primarily, I work with a program called the Center for Global Health and Healing, which involves some medical care services and other services for folks who are resettling. And through that program, we've developed some curriculum that we call Healing Encounters. And that curriculum is used to train resettlement staff, school administrators and other educators, healthcare providers, social workers, psychologists, many, many people who are providing care and services in various professional settings for folks who are coming here as trauma survivors from diverse cultural backgrounds. And so what I'm going to be doing today is sharing some of that, a tiny little snippet of that, what is often shared in one full day or two full days of workshops. Also, I wanted to let you know, through the RISE Project, which is a project that is connected with ICOM, they actually have a grant you can apply for. If you're involved in a group, let's say a church or a university or college group or something, and you want to bring some training to your group, that actually you can apply. It's like just a one-page grant application on their website, theriseproject.com. And it pays for my expenses to come and provide training in your setting. And there is money available. Basically, if you ask for it, you're gonna get it because there's money available. A lot of times people will ask me, well, is there money available like to start projects in my church? And that's something important to think about. Primarily what I'm hoping to provide is learning, is an opportunity for us to do the heart work and the mind work that we need to do before we even think about doing anything like programs and projects. That's kind of what I prefer to provide. So feel free to access that if you want to. Also on the RISE Project website, there's just a lot of resources, both about folks coming through refugee resettlement and then about international student ministry as well. There are some video workshops on there, like about 20 minutes long each, that people can use like in small groups. And then there are some study guides that you can use as well. So feel free to access those resources if you'd like. So always we're on a learning journey. So this is not about knowing everything. This is about beginning to learn. And this is about opening a window so that we go, wow, there's so much to know about this subject. That's all we have time to do today, is open that window and notice how much there is to be aware of. I hope this is the beginning, just like another step on your learning journey, and that you'll continue to pursue that learning journey. When we talk about how to live justly, love mercy, and walk humbly, those are things that we just are living into a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper each day. And in terms of learning how to make our circles big enough to include everyone from all backgrounds, for many of us that's a little bit new, for many of us who live in this country. We're kind of learning how to respond to that as Christ followers. So I'm hoping to provide a little bit of encouragement, a little bit of information, a little bit of support for your interest in that subject today. Remembering that, of course, we all carry many things with us into the room. So let's just take a moment, take a deep breath. and notice all the things that you carried into the room with you today. And have a moment to lay those down in the loving arms of our Savior so that we can have space in our hearts and minds for what Jesus wants us to learn today. God, we're so thankful for your love. We're so thankful that your love is so merciful. May you help us today to see anew how we can live into that mercy ourselves and how that mercy can flow through us into every encounter that we have with every person that we ever meet. We thank you in Jesus' name. I wanted to just start with the Leviticus 19 scripture. It's on the bottom of the first page of your scripture handout if you like to follow along. Some people like to just listen. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. I'm just going to read through that again slowly. Just notice what comes to your mind. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. And I'm going to just add a little phrase there. Do not mistreat them either intentionally or unintentionally. When a foreigner resides in your land, among you in the land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Now let's just stop for a minute and think about all that we hear in the news and political rhetoric these days about people who we would consider foreigners who have come to live among us. How would it affect that if we lived this out? The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Do you see how that erases the us and them? If they're treated as our native born, then they're no longer a foreigner. Then we're all us. Wouldn't it be amazing? How would it change things if we lived that out? Why? Because you were foreigners in Egypt. Because none of us is any more or less deserving of belonging and being home. This is from the Old Testament, but think about how this applies to what Jesus did for us on the cross. Do we have a right to be there? We're all foreigners at the foot of the cross, right? We're all foreigners. Not one of us belongs there except for mercy. Except for mercy. So when we're physically welcoming and bringing into our circles people who have come here who are foreign born, we get to physically live out what has happened to us spiritually. Isn't that an amazing, incredible, take your shoes off, you're on holy ground opportunity? We actually have an opportunity to live out physically what God has done for us spiritually. Amazing. Gives me chills when I think about that. So instead of figuring out how we can stay far away from those people who are different from us, what if we lived into that and went, oh yeah, this is exactly what I've experienced. Now I get to reflect that. I get to reflect what's happened on the cross for me in a physical way. Your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. So we're actually living out the kingdom of God on earth. Incredible, isn't it? Does it happen easily? No. Do we need to dedicate ourselves to figuring out how to turn our good intentions into good impact? Yes. So let's remind ourselves of that. We talked about this yesterday for those of you who were here. Oh, I'm just going to rewrite it. That got taken down. Remember this one as we talk today. This is one of those things that we struggle with sometimes, but it's so important to remember. Good intentions do not necessarily equal good impact. No matter how well-meaning we are, our good intentions don't necessarily equal good impact. We're entitled to this. This is really hard for us to give up. but absolutely essential. Because otherwise, if we don't think this way, we're going to just keep going, well, I'm just going to do what I do. And it's people are going to have to just get used to the way I do things. Because I mean well, right? But all of us have experienced a time when someone's good intentions toward us didn't actually have good impact on us. And that is absolutely true in any kind of cross-cultural work, intercultural work, and particularly for folks who are trauma survivors, which is what we're going to kind of focus on today. Gather my stuff back up here. So primarily what we want to focus on, always as we're talking about how do we engage with folks who have come from diverse backgrounds, not only people who have come through refugee resettlement, but lots of folks who've come through various forms of immigration. And just in case there's any doubt, I just want to remind us too that at the Cross there's no such thing as documented and undocumented. That in terms of My responsibility as a Christ follower to reflect the cross, that applies to everyone. There's no one that doesn't apply to. When people come through refugee resettlement, they do have papers. There are many other reasons why folks are concerned about people coming to this country through refugee resettlement, but we also have a lot of concerns about people who come without papers. And I'm not making a political statement about that. I'm just saying as Christ followers, always, with every human being, anywhere on the earth, what we get to do is reflect the love we find at the cross, which is all-inclusive and welcomes everyone, and not just welcomes, but actually brings us into a place of belonging. We're no longer foreigners. We're no longer foreigners. We come in as foreigners. We don't have a right to be there. It's not a birthright. We come in because Jesus adopted us, but then we're no longer foreigners. It is our place. It is our home. And that's what we get to reflect. So think about, if you would for a moment, the story of the Good Samaritan, what we call the story of the Good Samaritan. I know that you've heard it 1,000 times. I'm just going to really quickly read it through to you. If you like reading it to yourself, if you're a visual learner, it's on the back of the first page of your scriptures, so on page 2. And I know you've heard it, you maybe even had classes on it, but this time let's just read through it quickly and listen for what it tells us about mercy. What do you notice that this is telling us about God's mercy? He asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" In reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, pass by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after him,' he said, 'and when I return, I will reimburse you for any expense you have.' Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers?" The expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." What do you notice about mercy? What is that telling us? Anything you notice? He took pity. Okay, good. Got up there. He took pity and acted. Okay. What else do you notice about mercy in this? Oh, that's really, yeah, he had to give up his own agenda. How hard is that for us? Whew. Anything else? Thank you. He had to look past the differences Would you mind telling me again where what areas those differences were in? Different race. A different race and a different religion. Thank you. I wanted to really notice that. This person was a different race, a different language group, and a different religion. What about culture? Different culture, because religion affects culture and language affects culture, and culture affects language as well. Yeah, the least expected person to help. Isn't that amazing? Oops. Don't you love that Jesus didn't do this the opposite way, that he didn't have the Samaritan be the person hurting? And the people that would have been seen by the listeners as the heroes being the ones to go, oh yes, we looked past our differences to help this person, but the person that would have been hard for the listeners to tolerate is actually the hero of the story. So if you think of that in our present times, what does that tell us? That actually we have something to learn from the very people who we think are so far below us, that they don't have a place with us. That's pretty amazing, right? Was there trauma involved in this story? Yeah. Is it difficult sometimes to be around people who are suffering greatly? So there was that too, right? I don't know if you've ever noticed, but I think it's pretty normal for us as human beings to actually be so uncomfortable with someone who's really suffering greatly, to be uncomfortable enough that we stay away. Have you ever noticed that? I mean, that is so normal and so understandable, right? And what is more reflective of Christ than to step into that space and be present with someone who is suffering? And I know I can tell you from so many of my friends who've suffered on the refugee journey that they are worried about us. They think we can't handle their suffering. One woman said to me one day when she came to a clinic that I was interpreting at, and I could tell she was really struggling that day. She was really emotionally triggered, really dysregulated, really struggling. And she didn't know me well yet, but we speak the same language. I interpret in Swahili. So I was just asking her if she was okay, and she said, you know, I'm really suffering now that I'm finally in a place where I can sleep at night and don't have to worry about listening for guns and grenades. Much of my trauma is starting to come to the surface, which is very common. She said, but I can't tell you about it, because if I told you about it, it would be too much for you and too much for me. So for people to suffer and us to be willing to sit with people and not have to fix their problems all the time, we are such fixers. And some of that comes out of compassion, which is good. Some of it comes out of us thinking that we're the saviors of the world. That anyone from this country of a certain race, a certain language group, a certain education level, that we have everything that everybody else needs. Sometimes the most important thing we can do is just to be with. And the nice thing about that is it takes away the fear of being with someone who's suffering. Because we're often in over our heads in terms of trauma, right? In terms of being with someone who's suffering great trauma or has suffered great trauma. But if you go, what people need is my presence. I don't have to have any answers or any fixes. Imagine how healing it is to have someone who can sit with you. Whether you're speaking your trauma or not, sometimes people are just living it. Many people will never speak their trauma, but they're suffering nonetheless. To have someone sit with you and not be afraid, not be repulsed by the things that you've experienced when they're horrific, they're things that are unspeakable. But if someone will sit with you knowing that, whether it's spoken or not, and not be turned away by your suffering, is a healing presence, a healing reflection of Jesus in itself. That's how Jesus is with us, right? Jesus is not repulsed by our pain. Even when, and get this, even when we've caused it ourselves. Because remember, at the cross, there's no deserving or undeserving. So we don't have to worry about any of that. If a human being is suffering, our job is to be with, to walk beside, not to condescend, but to walk beside. Just to be present. Don't underestimate the power of that. As we mentioned yesterday, someone who has experienced a refugee background is a trauma survivor, 100%. They are either a primary or secondary trauma survivor. By definition, the legal definition of the word refugee is someone who has been forced to flee their home country to escape war, persecution, or violence. That's the legal definition. So by definition, folks who come through refugee resettlement, and many people who come through all other forms of immigration, are also trauma survivors. And in fact, many of us are trauma survivors. Trauma is pervasive. Anywhere you go, there are trauma survivors. And for those of you who ordered coffee, we'll just let them quietly distribute that, and we'll just keep going. But just so you know what the bustle is back there, there's Starbucks order being passed out. So as we begin to talk about the impact of trauma, I want to just note that as we were just saying, trauma is pervasive, and trauma is a heavy subject for all of us. So please feel free as we go through the next several minutes to take good care of yourself. For some people, it can be helpful to move around a little bit, sip some water or coffee or something. Don't forget to breathe. I'm not going to tell you specific trauma histories or stories, because those stories belong to people and they're theirs to tell, not mine. But just as we think about some of the forms of trauma that folks have experienced, it can feel a little heavy. So please feel free. Some people notice that they need to get up and move around. They go out and get a sip of water. Feel free to snack, drink, doodle, whatever is helpful to you. So let's go ahead real quick and look at there. You have a handout called The Impact of Trauma. At the top it says Healing Encounters. And then underneath of that it says Impact of Trauma. And I want to first talk just really briefly about what we mean by a healing encounter. The reason that we've called our curriculum that we teach Healing Encounters is this. When someone experiences trauma, and especially trauma at the hands of another or other human beings, when someone experiences trauma, there are three things that are taken during the trauma experience. Three things that are taken or stripped from the person during the trauma experience. And those three things are dignity, choice, and trust. When someone experiences trauma at the hands of other human beings, their dignity is taken. Now, we all know that God has given us some inherent dignity, but what is taken from a person is their view of their own dignity in the world. To have people or a person do something to you that you didn't ask for and can't stop. So these are things that affect us neurobiologically. So they affect us mind, body, and spirit. So one of the things that's taken from someone during the trauma experience is dignity. Another thing that is taken from a person is choice. Obviously, in a situation like that, if the person could choose for that thing to not happen, they would choose it. But trauma happens when something happens to someone that threatens their life or their well-being that they have no power or control over. So this is why for folks who have survived trauma, a very important factor in helping them to feel safe in any environment is feeling a little bit of control, a little bit of choice in what's happening to them. So dignity, choice, and the third thing that's taken from a person in the trauma experience is trust. Ability to trust other human beings, not only the ones who actually are the perpetrators, but the ability to trust other human beings, because it rocks your world and it switches some things in your brain. So the ability to trust other human beings, ability to trust yourself, and for many people, a crisis of faith, ability to trust God. So those three things are taken from a person. So that means an encounter that's healing for a trauma survivor will be one in which dignity, choice, and trust are in some way restored. Okay? So if I'm a trauma survivor, and you, and I have an encounter with you, and through that encounter, you treat me in such a way that I experience dignity, I experience choice as a human being. You're not just telling me what to do. I get to have choice and control in my own life. Those two things will build trust. So dignity plus choice equals trust. And then you have, imagine this, by having that kind of an encounter with a trauma or a torture survivor, we actually have an opportunity to replace a tiny layer, to restore a tiny layer of what was taken during the trauma experience. That's why we call it a healing encounter. Is that reflective of the cross at all? Is there restoration at the cross? Does Jesus give back to us what was lost? That one song we've been singing in the worship times about stepping out of the grave, this is reflective of that. This is life-giving. And by the way, if we're going to be reflecting the cross to trauma survivors, how about if we just reflect it to everybody? Isn't this what we all need? To have that love at the cross reflected to us. So what's beautiful about this is that it's not just sort of a little formula for how to do a certain kind of ministry. It's actually a way of being in the world that's reflective of the cross. You're meeting people all the time that are trauma survivors and you don't know it. How many people have survived something that not of their choosing? There are some of us in this room. So what if we just treat all people like this and reflect Jesus to each other all the time? So dignity, choice, and trust. One thing that can be a little bit heavy to hold about trauma survivors is that there are no neutral encounters. For someone who has survived trauma and torture or torture, there are no neutral encounters. So this is the thing that we call holding both. We're going to hold something very difficult and at the same time, not but, and at the same time we're going to hold something beautiful. For trauma survivors, there are no neutral encounters. That feels heavy, right? That feels like a lot of responsibility. Here's the good part. And, not but, and holding both at the same time. Because of that, every encounter can be a healing encounter. Every encounter has the potential to be a healing encounter, whether it's meeting someone in the grocery store, someone we're standing outside with as we're waiting to come in the library out of the rain, by being kind to someone, the person who's handing out free coffee in the park in Seattle when we're walking by, whoever it might be, every single encounter has the potential to be a healing encounter. Do you see where the holding both is? But remember the word and, not but. If I ever write a book someday called The Word That Changed My Life, it's going to be the word and. It's going to be the word and. We're holding two things. We're holding the difficulty and the beauty both. If we put but in there, we have to choose one or the other, and that doesn't work. So remember the word and. We're holding both. There are no neutral encounters. And because of that, every encounter has the potential to be a healing encounter. Forgive me, I feel like I'm talking really fast. It's because I'm looking at the clock back there. We lost about 20 minutes coming in the door, so I'm not wanting, I'm wanting for you to get all the good information that we have for you today. All right, let's look at that impact of trauma. Take a breath first. This can be a little bit difficult. These are this part that says extensive compound trauma. That's because for many people, the words extensive and compound mean for many people they've experienced more than one traumatic experience. So for many people it's throughout a childhood, throughout a lifetime, especially from oppressed minorities who have been a part of an oppressed minority their entire life. It's one after another. It's not one traumatic event for most people. And for many, many people it's more than one type of trauma. So this is a list of some of the types of trauma that folks have experienced coming here through refugee resettlement and other forms of immigration. And in some family systems, I've known some family systems in which every single one of these has been experienced in that family system. So we'll read through those really quickly together. In utero stress and trauma, early childhood trauma and breaks in attachment, sexual abuse and gender-based violence, physical, emotional, and psychological abuse, domestic violence, human rights violations, almost universal, inability to move about freely, stateless people groups, so folks who are not allowed to be citizens anywhere, they have no place to belong. If you've heard in the news, the Rohingya from Myanmar or Burma, those folks would be considered a stateless people group. They're not allowed to be citizens. Deprivation and neglect, discrimination and oppression, universal discrimination and oppression, political insecurity, police brutality, attacks, massacres, war, torture and kidnapping, extremely prevalent in some of our populations of folks from Iraq. Targeted due to ethnic, religious, political, gender-based, or sexual orientation, historical trauma, which is the generations-old trauma, experienced trauma, secondary trauma, and vicarious trauma. So that's a lot, right? It's important for us to hold this. It's important for us to know this, that this is what so many people in our world are carrying. Imagine how healing to have someone to just be present, to have a dignity-giving, mutually encouraging, long-term relationship with folks in the host country that you've come to try and make your home. Imagine the healing just of that. Even if the trauma story is never spoken, which, by the way, it most often won't be, that's okay. It's the presence. It's the willingness to be present. All right, the impact of trauma, the second part on the page. These things can be helpful to understand as you're building relationships with people, or if you're in a group, like let's say a church group or something, that's trying to, you know, provide a place for people to come in and belong and be included. It can be important to know these things. Often people are misunderstood what's happening for them, and it's really impact of trauma. Difficulty focusing or concentrating. Many people, by the way, have a hard time learning English for several of these reasons. I hear some really discriminatory comments about, well, people don't learn English. This person's been here for 8 years and they still don't learn English. Why don't people learn English? There are many trauma-based barriers, actually, to learning language. You'll notice them here. Difficulty retaining information, difficulty feeling secure and generalized fear, immobilizing fear and anxiety, where you freeze, you can't make a decision, you can't move forward. Hypervigilance, always watching out for things. Need to control your environment. That goes back to this one, right? Choice was taken away. So you feel a need to control your environment. Need to know what to expect to happen next. Profound mistrust of others. Difficulty trusting authority figures. Perception of persecution. That means you see discrimination and persecution everywhere. And a lot of times it's there, and sometimes it might not be, but you see it everywhere. Feelings of sadness, tearfulness, decreased range of emotion. Some people feel numb. They can't feel any emotions. Social isolation, interpersonal difficulties and conflict, loss of hope for the future, difficulty making decisions, feelings of ineffectiveness, difficulty completing tasks, difficulty falling and staying asleep. Many people struggle greatly with sleep. Nightmares. Resistance and oppositional behavior. Imagine how misunderstood that is as a symptom of trauma, when people appear to be resistant or oppositional. Imagine how easily offended we are if we don't understand what's happening. Yeah. Aggression towards others. How about that one? And think about how that symptom of trauma is misunderstood in today's climate of fear of people coming here through refugee resettlement to hurt us. And then somebody, maybe let's say a parent goes to their child's school and something has triggered a trauma or stress response in them. Maybe they feel their child has been discriminated against. And they come in to talk to the teacher or the principal and they're upset and they're emotionally dysregulated, and that comes through as aggression. They're not trying to hurt anybody, but it's an aggressive approach, right? Like, why are you doing this to my child? Imagine how misunderstood that is, because we're not doing our homework to know what's going on for people. Excessive compliance. Some people will agree with anything, whether they actually agree or not. Difficulty with self-regulation, limited impulse control. You imagine kiddos in school that are trauma survivors struggling with this one. Shame and guilt, dissociation or dissociative sleep, that's when you kind of leave your body and go somewhere else to escape the pain. Reenactment of trauma, parallel process of survival responses, so fight or flight, you're probably familiar with that. Also, these days we talk a lot about freeze and cling. Stress often experienced as if the trauma is reoccurring. And then it says little T's often is experienced as big T's. So I want to talk about that for a minute. One thing that we notice for trauma survivors, and this term little T, big T comes out of EMDR, which is trauma therapy that's used with some people. When we talk about big T trauma, we're talking about those life-threatening, well-being-threatening types of trauma. Okay, so the ones where someone either feels that for themselves or someone that they're close to, their life is being threatened or their well-being is being threatened. So folks who have come here through refugee resettlement are all big T survivors. Many of the rest of us are big T survivors. Many of us have childhood trauma that would be a big T trauma, any form of child abuse, sexual abuse, many, many forms of big T trauma happening to so many people, right? Then there's little T trauma, which all of us experience, whether or not we're a big T trauma survivor. And those are the disturbing, unsettling events that happen to all of us pretty much on a daily basis. Someone pulls out of you in front of you in traffic, and your heart starts beating, and you get upset, right? And you become dysregulated. So what we mean by that is when you're regulated, it's when you're in your calm, wise state. Have you ever noticed how when you become dysregulated, when you get kind of upset or jolted about something, you're not your wisest self? Have you ever noticed that? It's a little harder to listen to the Holy Spirit. Those times you say things you wish you hadn't said. Later you look back and you go, what was I? What? Why did I say and why did I act like that, right? That's what we mean by dysregulated. So those little T traumas. A lot of us have little T traumas if we think back to our school years, a time when maybe a teacher unintentionally shamed you in front of the class, or another student said things about you, you know, called you names or whatever, anything that causes shame. Those disturbing, unsettling events, not life-threatening, but disturbing. Those are little T traumas, okay? So here's the thing to know about trauma survivors. For trauma survivors, little T's are often experienced as big T's. Little T trauma is often experienced as big T trauma. This is important to know because sometimes people don't understand themselves. They're like, this seemed like such a little thing. Why am I so upset by it? Right? A lot of times it's because, you know, our brains are a network of connections, right? A network of associations. Everything associates with something. Have you ever been maybe doing the dishes or something and suddenly your mind goes to something and you're like, why did I even think about that? It's because our brain is constantly associating. So this is true for all of us. And a lot of times for big T trauma survivors, a little T is experienced in the body and neurobiologically as a big T trauma. So let's say, for example, actually let me give you an example. A while back at our maternal child clinic, we had a mom come in. She was a newcomer in the country. She arrived in this country several months pregnant. So you can imagine already, she has no English proficiency. She's come from an extremely oppressed minority group in Central Africa. She comes to this country. She comes to this clinic. She gets there a few minutes early, and unfortunately her interpreter had not arrived yet. So at that point, nothing should have been done. The people that were there should have waited for her interpreter, but with good intentions, because remember, good intentions don't always equal good impact. Good intentions are better than bad intentions, but they don't always equal good impact. With good intentions, the person who was the receptionist there at that clinic saw her and knew that she was a new patient. It was her first time to visit. So she thought, well, I'll just help the midwives to get a little bit ahead on their schedule. She knows the woman doesn't speak English, so she goes over to her and tells her to come like this. First of all, anybody know anything about that culturally? So for many cultures, this is highly, highly insulting. So already, because she didn't know what was going on in terms of culture, language, or trauma. Yesterday we talked about those three circles, culture, language, and trauma, right? And good intentions, so we're not putting her down. I'm just telling you what happened. Anyway, the woman gets the idea, so she follows her. You can think about some of those things. She didn't know what to expect to happen next. She's a trauma survivor. She's being led somewhere. She doesn't know where she's going. There's no one there to interpret for her, to tell her what's happening. She has the woman come over and stand against a wall, gets a camera out from behind her desk, and goes over and stands in front of her and takes her picture. The woman doesn't know why her picture is being taken. She doesn't know what's happening. Now, really, really good intentions. Here's the intentions. What they found is that for a lot of women, when they go over to labor and delivery to have their baby and they walk in, and they're a little bit dysregulated because they're in labor, no one knows what language they speak. So someone at the hospital thought it would be a good idea to give these women a badge with their picture on it. So similar to what you're wearing, but with their picture. And underneath of it, it would say what language they speak. That way, if a woman comes in and she's in labor, we can see, yes, this really is the person. We see her picture, and we can know what language, and we can call for an interpreter. Really, really good intentions, right? Here's the thing, though. For this woman, in her particular trauma background, people were identified as part of a persecuted minority with a badge that had their picture on it, their name on it, and their language listed. Because language in an African country where there's 1,000 languages indicates ethnic origins. So you're identified by your facial features, the language you speak, and many times your name can tell someone what your ethnic origin is. So this woman comes in with no explanation, is stood in front of a thing, takes a picture, and then someone comes out, processes the picture, makes the badge, and hangs it over her neck. So you know fight or flight, right? Well, this woman had survived by running, so she ran. It was months before we were able to repair that damage and get her back into clinic for care. Good intentions, but we hadn't done our homework enough. So you can see how little t, that in itself, putting that badge over here, that was not life-threatening. But how did she experience it? It was a little t, and she experienced it as a big T. Her body responded in the same way as it had when she was running for her life. It responded in flight mode. Some people respond in fight mode. Imagine how well that goes over. Usually people don't, you know, try to hurt anyone, but fight can mean anything aggressive. Fight just means you move toward the trauma, toward the danger. You survive by moving toward it. Flight means you survive by moving away from it. Freeze means you survive by freezing, becoming immobilized. For some people, that means hiding. For some people, that means overcompliance. A lot of times, people freeze if they can't fight or flee. So you can see what I mean by this big T, little T thing, right? Little T's are often experienced as big T's. Now imagine if everyone who is friends with someone who is a trauma survivor or family members of someone who's a trauma survivor understood this. What difference would it make? Imagine if we understood this about ourselves. And imagine how much more we can reflect the love of Jesus in a hurting, hurting world. Right? That's the beauty of the healing. By his wounds, we are healed. Because someone doesn't have to deserve a healing encounter. No one is more or less deserving than anyone else. Unbelievably, our time is almost gone. Oh. How are you guys doing? Don't forget to breathe. This can be a little bit heavy. I'm going to let you look at the one that says healing encounters at the top, and then it says situational factors that can cause a trauma response. We're not going to kind of read through probably all of those together just because of time today, but this is a good thing to know and understand. We can't always avoid things that trigger a trauma response for people, that trigger someone to experience as a little T as a big T, But it's really helpful to be aware of how many things can be triggering to people. So I'm going to let you just take that with you as a resource. I did want to notice together, if you look about halfway down the first column, there's one that says being asked to tell your story. Do you see that one? Being asked to tell your story. And I did want to touch on this one specifically because I know that many of you are people who are wanting to build friendships, relationships with people who are trauma survivors from diverse backgrounds. So I wanted to give you something really practical to hold on to with this one so that you walk out of here with something that you go, okay, this is something I can really practically apply easily. I wish we had hours together, honestly, because I can see in your faces the earnestness and the concern about this subject. So please do feel free to contact me. But I wanted to talk about being asked to tell your story because there's actually all three of those things, culture, language, and trauma involved in this. So culturally, in many Western cultures, U.S. culture included, you may have noticed that oftentimes we show interest in a person and we build friendship by asking them questions about themselves. So if I was meeting you for the first time, it would be culturally appropriate for me to say, hi, how are you? Where are you from? How old are you, possibly, especially if you're a young person, or what year in school are you? Tell me more about your family, tell me about your life, or even tell me your story. And that actually, we would consider that, oh, this person's really interested in me. It's culturally for us, it's a complementary thing. It's something that shows interest in building a relationship. So for many less direct cultures, that's not actually true. Asking someone for their personal information is concerning for people, especially when it's someone from a position of power and privilege asking someone in a position of less power and privilege, which anyone that's from a cultural minority and religious minority and ethnic minority in this country would see themselves as having less power and privilege than someone who is from the ethnic majority. So culturally, that's not as widely practiced. But more importantly, for survivors of trauma stories, being asked their story can be a trauma trigger in itself. So this is something that we just don't know what we don't know, right? This is an example of good intentions that don't equal good impact when we're just thinking, well, we mean well, so I'll just go ask them to tell me their story. Without doing our homework, without knowing, without preparing and shifting our minds and hearts, taking off our own lens and being willing to look through a different lens, with good intentions, we can often do harm. So I actually have some quotes to share with you from some of my friends who have come to this country through refugee resettlement. This represents diverse group of people, diverse cultural, linguistic, religious backgrounds. And this is just a few, six or seven quotes that I wanted to share with you. So you'll hear from them what it feels like to be asked to tell your story. I always feel lonely when someone asks me to tell what happened to me. It makes me wonder if they are only talking to me because they want to hear a story about suffering, not because they want to know me. We're kind of an entertainment culture, right? If you can entertain me with your story and better yet tug at my heartstrings, then I'll decide you're deserving of my support. But what about if we never know the story? Here's another quote. I wish people could understand that every time someone asks me to tell about the terrible things that happened to me, it takes me back to that time and I feel like I'm experiencing it all again. You notice the big T, little T in that. Good intentions. We ask people to tell their stories. Often we'll ask someone to come to our church because we think if we could get someone to come to our church or our group, whatever it is, and tell their story about what's happened to them, then people will be more supportive of folks who are coming here through refugee resettlement. What's wrong with that? If we can get someone to come and tell about all the awful things that happened to them, then we'll be doing a good thing because then people will say, okay, you deserve to be here. But do we really, as Christ followers, do we really want to go into deserving and undeserving? Does someone really have to entertain us with their story in order for us to say, oh, okay, we'll do the right thing here? Or is what Jesus showed us enough? but we do it because that's who Jesus is. Here's another one. When people hear my accent, did you notice also, by the way, on that list was attention to accent? Even positive. See, here's another one most of us don't know, right? I didn't know this until I learned it. For many people, attention to accent can cause stress and a trauma response. Because for some people, that is how they were identified as part of the group they were part of. They were identified to be persecuted by accent. Also, it makes some people feel like it's that us and them thing, right? It's pointing out that you're different. So even with good intentions, when we say, oh, I love your accent, say that again. Right? And we've all done this because we don't know. For many people, that feels like you're separating me. By the way, as we talk about these things, when something comes up that you think, oh, shoot, I've done that, that's normal. In that moment, you have a choice. You can choose humility or humiliation. We're on a learning journey. If we choose humiliation, we'll get defensive or feel shame, which will prevent us from learning and from taking care of the other person. If we choose humility, we'll be a learner, and it will enable us to be able to take care of the other person and to go back and repair what we've done. So learning. It's okay if you're noticing things, ooh, I didn't know that before. That's called growth. 5 years from now, you'll look back on this and you'll say, oh, I didn't know that then. Keep growing, but stay in humility. When people hear my accent and see the way I dress, they seem to think that means they have a right to know everything about me. I am not comfortable talking about my past, but I feel like I have to tell them, or they might think I am ungrateful. Do you see how much power we have? That people will, and often when we ask people to speak and tell their story in a group, they'll do it and then sometimes suffer for days afterwards. A few people, by the way, at some point in their healing journey, find healing by talking about their trauma. A few, but not most. And the important thing is, remember this one? Choice. I'm not going to turn the page, but remember about choice. The trauma survivor always needs to be in control of their own information. If someone chooses to talk to you without you asking, that's great. You receive it. You validate it. You listen. You don't ask further questions. But that person always chooses. We don't choose for them. Okay, here's another quote. When somebody asks me personal questions, I start to feel worried and scared because back home when I was questioned about who I was and where I came from, that could mean I was going to be taken away or hurt. Big T, little T. And two more. I feel a broken heart when I have to explain my identity. And lastly, can't people just like me for who I am, even if they don't know my story? So there's, I think, something we can grasp onto as we finish up today. When you're building friendships with people, remember you're looking for mutual friendships. You're looking for dignity-giving friendships, not being the rescuer, being the partner, right? Talk about the here and now. People always ask me, well, then what are we going to talk about? If I can't ask them their story, what are we going to talk about? That's a valid question. Talk about the here and now. Talk about what your favorite class is in school. Talk about, you know, we both like soccer. Who's your favorite team? Talk about if it's a parent, your children. How are your children doing in school? What are their ages? And mostly, you can talk about yourself. One thing you can do, because sometimes folks are uncomfortable with questions, what I'll often do when I meet people is say, I've lived in Boise myself since 2008. I've lived here for about 9 years. That way, if someone wants to go, oh, I've only been here 1 year, or I just got here last month, they can, but if they don't want to tell me, they don't have to. I've shared my own personal information. That's an invitation to share. Or I might say, I have 4 children, and sometimes people will say, I have 7, I have 1, I had 3, but I lost them all. Or some people will say, oh, that's nice. So that's something practical you can always do. It's an invitation for people to talk, but the choice is theirs. But if you're building a friendship with someone, you're getting to know each other, talk about things you share in common now. Most people say talk about the here and now. This one person who, I didn't read this quote, but this is just one that I read from an article. This is a person named Zina Schwitzel, who was resettled in Belgium. She says, the article was called Show Your Love for Refugees But Respect Their Privacy. She says, very often we went through things that you only have seen in movies. Don't ask too many detailed questions about the problems from the past, but rather focus on the future. People didn't come here to share how bad their journey was. They came here to start a new life. Right? So build that trust with people through dignity and choice. And if eventually someone wants to share their story with you, they might. But either way, don't underestimate the healing power of reflecting Christ's love through your presence. Jesus didn't come to take away all of our suffering. He came to inhabit it. And that's what we get to reflect into a world that is hurting. And that's where the holding both comes in. The suffering, the heaviness, the pain, and the immense beauty and joy of being able to have our hearts barefoot on the holy ground of being present with suffering people. Our time is gone and past. Thank you so much for being here this morning. Greatly appreciate it. Thank you.